Who were the Nisei Japanese American soldiers? What were their struggles and contributions to the American war effort in World War II? What is the lingering impact of their service in the modern Army and American culture? For answers to these questions and more Army History Insights, stay tuned.
Welcome to the U.S. Army History and Heritage Podcast, the official podcast of the United States Army's Center of Military History. The Center of Military History writes and publishes the Army's official history, manages the U.S. Army Museum Enterprise, and provides historical support throughout the U.S. Army.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the United States Army History and Heritage Podcast. I'm Lee Reynolds, the Strategic Communications Officer for the Center of Military History. In this episode, we are examining the role of the Nisei soldiers, the second-generation Japanese-Americans in World War II, with a focus on the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Joining me for this discussion is Dr. Mitchell Maki. Thank you, Dr. Maki, for being here.
Thank you, Lee, for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yes, yeah, me too. You're an expert on this topic, so I'm really anxious to find out what you have to say. So let me just give the audience a little background on who you are. So Dr. Mitchell Maki is one of the premier scholars on the Japanese-American Redress Movement and is the president of the Go for Broke National Education Center, a nonprofit organization based in Los Angeles's historic Little Tokyo District. Through its educational programming and archival resources, the Go for Broke National Education Center is committed to maintaining and contemporarily applying the legacy of the Japanese-American veterans of World War II. Dr. Maki is the lead author of the award-winning book, Achieving the Impossible Dream, How Japanese Americans Obtained Redress. Prior to his current position, he had a distinguished 27-year career in higher education, including acting provost and vice president of academic affairs at California State University, Dominguez Hills, and acting dean of the College of Health and Human Services at California State University, Los Angeles. All right, well, Dr. Maki, definitely impressive credentials there. So before we get into the discussion of the Nisei soldiers, I'd like to first get a little bit of a strategic setting here. If you could focus a little bit on the history of how and why they came into existence. So, like, first of all, can you describe what was the Japanese-American experience from Pearl Harbor to the incarceration of Japanese Americans in World War II?
Sure. I'd like to go back a little bit further, Lee, if I may, to just say that Japanese from Japan began immigrating to the United States in the late 1800s. First to Hawaii, which was a territory, and then, of course, to the continental United States, primarily along the West Coast. And they came primarily first as laborers, but then women, Japanese women, started coming and they began establishing families. So by the time World War II and Pearl Harbor happened, Japanese had been in the United States for 50 years, 40 years. My own grandparents came at the turn of the 1900s and, the early 1900s and so forth. So that's the context in which Pearl Harbor takes place. So December 7th, 1941, the Imperial Nation of Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and it thrusts the United States into World War II. And Japanese in America, two-thirds of whom were American citizens by birth, began to wonder what would happen to us. Would we be treated like the American citizens that we were? As I mentioned, two-thirds of us had been born here. The other third had lived here 30, 40, 50 years. Or would we be treated like the enemy, because we shared a common heritage? Well, we got our answer 2 months after Pearl Harbor, when Franklin Roosevelt signs Executive Order 9066, which creates the underpinnings by which nearly 120,000 individuals of Japanese descent would be forcibly excluded from the continental U.S.'s West Coast and incarcerated in camps across the United States for the duration of the war. And in Hawaii, the Japanese were not incarcerated en masse. The leaders were singled out, taken out, and sent to many of these camps across the United States. But the population of Japanese Americans in Hawaii was pretty much left alone and were subject to all the laws and regulations that everyone was subject to at that particular time. And so it's in this context that, you know, Japanese Americans on the continent are incarcerated. Japanese in Hawaii are oftentimes distrusted by the government, seen as possible saboteurs and so forth. But it was out of this context that they created the 100th Battalion and eventually the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. And initially, Japanese American young men are asked to volunteer, and then eventually they're drafted into service for this unit.
When were they initially asked to volunteer?
They were initially asked to volunteer in about 1943, the beginning of 1943. What happens, and it's a very complicated and with a lot of moving parts and so forth, but Japanese Americans in Hawaii, many of them were serving in the Hawaii Army National Guard. And for the days right after Pearl Harbor, they helped guard the island and they took up positions and so forth. But 3 days after Pearl Harbor on December 10th, Japanese Americans were stripped of their rifles and declared 4C aliens unfit for duty. Eventually, they were sidelined until they were activated in June of 1942. So essentially 6 months after Pearl Harbor, they were activated and created the 100th Battalion. And they were sent to Camp McCoy in Wisconsin and then Camp Shelby in Mississippi. So these guys were already in the service, right? But because of their tremendous training and so forth, the 442nd was created. And it was for the 442nd, the young Japanese Americans on the mainland as well as in Hawaii were asked to volunteer.
But then why did they volunteer when they see how, you know, people of their heritage are being treated in the United States? Why serve?
That is such the question, right? Imagine you're 20 years old. You're a young male Japanese American born in this country, and you see yourself as an American. And yet your family has lost everything. You know, I'm talking about those that were on the continental U.S. They've lost their homes, their jobs, their communities. Many of them have to leave school if they were in higher ed and so forth. But most of all, what they lost was their sense of place at the American table of citizenship. Were we Americans or weren't we in terms of the eyes of the government? But in their hearts, they knew who they were. They knew they were Americans. Many of them had no connection to Japan other than the fact that their parents had come from Japan many, many years earlier. But that was the question. How do you serve a nation that distrusts you and your community? But for many of these young Japanese American soldiers, eventual soldiers, they understood that the only way to create a better future and a chance for their families was to serve in the Army and to answer this call. We, at that time, were looked at with great suspicion, and to not respond to the call would be seen as validating the fact that we were not American, that we could not be trusted. Now, conversely, many people would say, yeah, but you can't support a nation that has stripped your family of everything. And the other argument on a very personal level was that for many of these young men, they were maybe the oldest son in their family, and they're in the middle of a desert, surrounded by barbed wire, not knowing what their future held. And for some of these young men, their families were saying, don't go, keep the family together. We've lost everything. We've got to stay together. So, you know, there's that familial, personal tie to stay with mom and dad, who some of them didn't speak English very well, and they're getting older and so forth. You know, so it's hard to abandon mom and dad in the middle of the desert. But for many of these young men, they understood that the call was even greater than serving the U.S. It was serving their own community, and creating a future for those they love and for those that they would never know.
Yeah, and you know, as you're talking about that, we've done some other podcasts in the past about Native Americans, about African Americans, and it's really the same question. Why did they serve when, you know, a lot of America has really turned their back on you or were acting in very racist ways? But they joined for the same reasons. They supported, you know, hoping for a better future and to show that they were Americans.
And, you know, what we oftentimes say at Go for Broke National Education Center is that these young men fought to uphold the wisdom of America's promise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the promise that in our nation, no one is to be judged by the color of their skin, the nation of their origin, or the faith that they choose to keep. And here are these young men. They weren't the right color, right? They weren't white at that particular time. Their parents had immigrated from the country with which we were at war. And for many of them, they weren't Christian. They were Buddhist, you know, and yet they chose to serve. And as we're about to talk about, would go on to become the most highly decorated unit of their size and length of service in American military history. And it speaks to the power of America's promise.
Yeah, I love that term, you know, the wisdom of America's promise. And I think that's very inspiring, I mean, even to today. But so let's then transition into that. You talked about the 100th Battalion. You mentioned the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. So let's go a little bit more in depth about the formation of these units and what was their role and where did they get sent?
So the 100th starts off because they started basic training in June of 1942, and they're eventually deployed in September of 1943. They go to Italy. They start off in Salerno, Italy. And what's amazing is in their first 8 weeks of combat, they are awarded six Distinguished Service Cross. So, you know, just immediately, they hit the ground running. They go on to fight in Cassino and then Anzio. They earned the nickname the Purple Heart Battalion. You know, unfortunately, it's because they earned so many Purple Hearts because so many of them were wounded or killed. They were known as the Little Men of Iron because it was their stature. And it's important for us to realize that these were not big men. I mean, literally, they averaged 5'3", 5'4", 125, 130 pounds. We received a jacket here at Go for Broke where we were putting it on a mannequin. So we ordered an adult small mannequin. It was too large, and we had to go back and get a child large mannequin, and that's what the jacket fit on. So these were just young but very tough young men.
Right, and then you mentioned that they went into to Italy initially, and from what I remember in some of my previous readings is that they were intentionally sent over to Europe because they didn't want the Japanese American units involved in the Pacific campaign. And how true is that?
Well, and you know, two things go hand in hand. They sent them to Europe because that way they would not be confused with the enemy join the enemy, because again, Japanese Americans were viewed with great distrust and suspicion initially, but that quickly changed as the commanding officers just saw, you know, the gallantry and the effectiveness of these young men on the battlefield. So, you know, part of it was that, and there was also an argument that was supported by the Japanese-American community that it be a segregated unit. And part of the reason for that was that if we scattered these, you know, thousands of young Japanese-Americans across the many different units, whatever they did, whatever they contributed, could possibly be very easily lost. Versus if we concentrated them in one unit, you know, they would have to go for broke and they would have to demonstrate the loyalty as well as their commitment to our nation.
Yeah, and to talk about the segregated units, because who commanded them? Who was in charge of these units?
General Mark Clark was the general that initially took them on. Eisenhower did not want them. General Clark said, I'll take them, and he kept them throughout the war and overseeing their basic movement.
But was the 100th completely led by Japanese Americans, or did they have white officers?
Oh, they had a good they had white officers. So there were a couple of officers that eventually were Japanese Americans, and most the highest rank that I'm familiar with is lieutenant or captain. But the generals that oversaw them, on the battlefield were white. And when I said General Mark Clark, I'm talking at a very high level. There were other generals like Dahlquist who oversaw them in France and so forth. So the 100th is eventually joined by the 442nd, and they become one active unit that is deployed not only in Italy, but also sent over to France. And that's where they had one of their most famous battles, which is in October and November of 1944. They liberate Brières and Villefontaine, but also the battle known as the Rescue of the Lost Battalion. And that was the story of, there was a Texas battalion of soldiers, about 275 of them, that were surrounded in the Vosges Mountains in the forest by Nazi troops. And the U.S. Army had tried to send in several battalions to save them. They tried literally shooting in rations and other supplies to them, and that wasn't very effective. Finally, they said, let's send in the 442nd, the 100th 442nd, because they have been effective in the past. But the subtext was, and also that they are expendable. So the 100th 442nd entered into the Vosges Mountains, into the forest, understanding that all of them would go in, but not all of them would walk out. And certain, true to form, they did break through the Nazi line. They did rescue about 211 white American soldiers from that Texas battalion, but in the process took over 300 casualties. And so that's the math of the day. But it was highly publicized in the United States. Film clips of this were being shown in movie theaters at that time. And it was one of the first positive representations of Japanese Americans during World War II.
Wow. And you keep talking go for broke. So I know that was the motto, was it of the 100th or 442nd? And can you tell us how they went about getting that motto?
The motto, go for broke, is the motto of the 442nd. The motto of the 100th was remember Pearl Harbor. And remember, because the 100th guys were all from Hawaii originally, the initial guys. But it's a great history of that in terms of go for broke is actually a gambling term. And it comes from Hawaii. And many of the young men from Hawaii, they love to gamble. That's just part of the local culture in Hawaii at that particular time. And go for broke essentially means go all in. Go for the big win. Give it your all. And that was the attitude, that was the feeling and the spirit that they brought into their unit and saying, we're going to go for broke. We're going to give it our all. Nothing's holding us back. We're all in.
All right, great. And then we'll come back to Europe, but there's another side to the Nisei that's very interesting, is the military intelligence service part of it, communications. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. And this is oftentimes the unheard or untold part of the World War II story, because for many years, their contributions were classified. And for decades, these young men would not talk about what they did. And I could tell you story upon story of families in the 1980s and 1990s still not knowing that their fathers had served in the military intelligence service in the Pacific Theater. So essentially, these were young Japanese-American men who had linguistic abilities to speak and write in Japanese, or the ability to improve their understanding of the language by going to the language school. Many of them grew up in households where possibly their parents spoke Japanese and encouraged them to learn how to write it. Some of these men were known as K, Chibe, which were American-born Japanese that were sent back to Japan in their early years, elementary school, high school, to be educated in Japan, and then came back to the United States. So they had the ability to speak and write in Japanese. These men would be assigned, unlike the 442nd, which was in a segregated unit, these men would be assigned to different Marine units in the Pacific Theater. Oftentimes, they would be the only one in their unit. So it was a very isolating experience from an ethnic standpoint. But from a cultural standpoint, these were American men. So they understood. They served as linguistic experts. They served as translators and interrogators. They would interview captured soldiers. They would intercept messages. But even more so, there are stories of how they would crawl through the jungle to crawl up right next to the Japanese camp, listen, eavesdrop on what the Japanese commanders were saying, and then crawl back through the jungle to their American unit and tell them, hey, tomorrow morning, this and this is going to happen. So General MacArthur even said that no fighting unit had ever been as well informed as the Americans were during World War II because of these young translators in the MIF.
And they were called Nisei also?
They were Nisei also, yes. They were American-born. All these guys were American-born. Some of them may have spent a couple of years in Japan learning the language and so forth. But it gets even better than that, Lee, because there are stories of these translators literally crawling into caves to talk either Japanese or Okinawan civilians to come out of the cave, or to convince Japanese soldiers who were armed in those caves to come out and surrender because they were either surrounded or the war was nearing an end or there was no reason to continue the hostilities. And it's just an amazing thought to think of a young man crawling into a cave, possibly armed or unarmed at that time, to convince armed enemy combatants to come out. And they were successful in saving not thousands, but literally tens of thousands of lives of the civilians who were holed up in these caves, especially in places like Saipan and Okinawa.
Yeah, and then, we've been talking about the young Japanese men, Nisei, but I understand that they were women also as nurses or wax. Can you talk about that?
That is correct. That there were literally hundreds of young Japanese-American women born in America, same generation, who said, we want to do our part too. Obviously, at that time, women didn't serve as combatants on the battlefield. But they would sign up either through the Women's Army Corps or as nurse cadets or Army nurse cadets and serve stateside. And in doing so, freeing up the literal manpower to go fight across the ocean.
Yeah, so it's good to know that it was both men and women, and in both theaters, the European and the Pacific Theater.
Yeah,
and like you said, I didn't know really until prepping for this that we had any Nisei that were serving in the Pacific. So really a good point to focus on here.
The other thing that the MIS contributed is after the war ended, the MIS stayed in occupied Japan. They helped with the war crime trials. They helped with the reintegration of hundreds of thousands of Japanese soldiers coming back into an impoverished nation. They helped with the rebuilding of Japan and even the composition of the Japanese constitution that stands today.
Let's get back a little bit back over to the 442nd and the 100th. So after Italy, they still played a big role in the rest of the European theater. So let's pick that up there. So after the Italian campaign, where did we see them fighting next?
Well, so toward the end of the war, a couple of things to point out is they were very instrumental in the breaking of the Gothic line and towards the end of the war in Italy, where literally they scaled the backside of a cliff in the middle of the night and to hear these soldiers talking about this story where they were saying, you know, it was pitch black. You could barely see in front of you. You had your hand on the soldier in front of you as they were scaling the backside of the cliff to do a surprise attack on the Nazis in the morning. And they had made a commitment to one another that if any of them fell, they would not cry out because that would give away the position. Sure enough, in the morning, and they positioned themselves, and the army had been trying to break through the Gothic line for many, many months, but the Nazis were not suspecting that there would be an attack from the rear. And in the morning, the 142nd was able to break through the Gothic line in less than an hour. And that signaled the beginning of the end of the war, as then the U.S. Army was able to head north and start pushing the Nazis back into Germany and so forth. The other interesting story that often goes untold is that towards the end of the war, the army was pushing the Nazis back into Germany, and the 522nd, which was the artillery unit of the 442nd, was part of the tip of the spear that was pushing the Nazis back into Germany. And as they proceeded to push back, they came across an installation. It was this large building surrounding by fences and so forth. They didn't know what it was. And as they approached this installation, they saw lumps on the ground covered with snow. And they figured it were logs covered with snow. But to their horror, they realized that these weren't logs, but they were, in fact, bodies of dead Jewish inmates. And this was a satellite of Dachau. And they flung open the gates. They were able to liberate, you know, Jewish inmates. And if you can imagine the irony in that moment, as these young Japanese-American soldiers are liberating Jews halfway across the world, while their own families were still being incarcerated back in the United States.
Who are some of the standout members of the Nisei that people today may recognize their names?
Probably the most famous individual was Dan Inouye. Dan Inouye would go on to become a senator, and before his death in 2012 was the Senate pro tem. So here he was a member of the 442nd, in 1944 and 1945, and then with 70 years later, become third in line to the presidency of the United States as Senator Pro Tem. There were others that received the Medal of Honor medal, which is the highest medal that the Army bestows upon its soldiers. Sadao Munimori, a son of Glendale, was honored as the first recipient of the Medal of Honor, first Japanese-American recipient of the Medal of Honor. And interestingly enough, later this year, in December, the city of Glendale is going to be naming a major intersection after Sadao Munimori, and that unveiling will happen on December 9th. So even 80 years after the end of the war, we are still recognizing these young men for what they did during a time of great international crisis.
Right. And then that's in Glendale, California.
Glendale, California. Yeah.
For some of the things that you're talking about right now, I know we, Center Military History, we oversee the Army Museum Enterprise. And in Hawaii, we have a fantastic museum down there right in the heart of Waikiki at Fort DeRussy.
Yeah.
That covers a lot about...
In there.
Yes. And so it covers a lot about the Nisei, our new National Museum of the U.S. Army, which is in here in Northern Virginia. They have a whole section about the Nisei. So if anyone has an opportunity to see one an Army museum, I do encourage you to go because their stories are well documented in our Army Museum Enterprise. A little side note there. But so I want to move on. So let's talk a little bit more about the legacy. What was the impact that the lessons learned from America's treatment of these Japanese Americans during World War II has had on current-day challenges to civil liberties, racial equality, and including the passage of the Civil Liberties Act in 1988.
So after the war, these young men came back to their communities, whether on the mainland or in Hawaii, and they were changed. They no longer wanted to come back and be treated as second-class citizens. They had died and bled on the battlefield for our nation, and they wanted to be treated, and rightfully so, as full-class citizens. And in Hawaii, in particular, the soldiers would come back. Many of them took advantage of the GI Bill and went back to college and were a significant part of the Democratic Revolution that took place in the 1950s in Hawaii. And they emerged as the business leaders, the education leaders, and most importantly at the time, the political leaders of Hawaii. And they contributed in a major way to statehood of Hawaii in 1959. And for any of your listeners who have ever been to Hawaii, I think it's beyond argument that Japanese Americans in Hawaii play a major role politically, educationally, and in the business world. And, you know, they've had several Japanese American governors, several Japanese American senators and representatives. Nobody goes through a public school system in Hawaii without having a Japanese American teacher or a Japanese American principal. And many of the leaders are of Japanese descent, Japanese American, several generations old. So they helped to transform Hawaii into the state that we currently know today. You also mentioned the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, and that's the act which provided a presidential apology and monetary reparations to those affected by Executive Order 9066. And this was an act that was the culmination of grassroots campaigning for several decades. But let me cut to the chase in terms of how the Japanese American soldier story directly affected the passage of the Civil Liberties Act. Well, on one hand, the actions of the soldiers demonstrated beyond reproach the loyalty of the Japanese American community. As Senator Inoue would say, I just had to mention the 442nd and look at others and say, where were you? You know, it was so clear that the community had demonstrated its loyalty in blood. But the bill passes the House on September 17, 1987. It passes the Senate in April of 1988. And we now needed only one more supporter, one more signature. And that would be, of course, the President of the United States. And in 1988, it was none other than Ronald Reagan. And for those of your listeners who remember Ronald Reagan, he was a very conservative president. And for many people, we thought there was no way that Ronald Reagan was going to sign the Civil Liberties Act. But the other part about Ronald Reagan that is true is that Ronald Reagan, whether you agreed with his policies or not, most people would agree that he was a great communicator. He had the ability to tell stories that would touch people's hearts and move them in a certain direction. But the opposite was true of Ronald Reagan. If you could tell him a story that would touch his heart, you could have a great advocate on your hands. So the question was, what story could we tell Ronald Reagan that would personalize this issue of the incarceration and what happened to Japanese Americans during World War II? What would personalize it for him? Well, back in World War II, there was a young soldier named Kazuo Masuda. And Kazuo Masuda was a sergeant in the 442nd. And he was asked, why are you doing this? Why are you fighting for this nation that has incarcerated your family? And his answer was the answer that I think many of the Nisei soldiers would have given, which was, because this is the only way I know that my family can have a chance in America. Right or wrong, agree with it or not, Sergeant Masuda and the thousands of other Nisei soldiers understood that in 1943, 1944, and 1945, loyalty needed to be demonstrated in blood. 2 weeks after he gave that comment, Sergeant Masuda was killed in battle in Italy, fighting for his country, the United States of America. Well, after the war, his family is released from the camp in Gila River, Arizona, and they try to move back to Santa Ana, California, which is their hometown. And they're met with nothing but hate speech, racial taunts, and threats of bodily harm. The Army realizes this is a PR fiasco, that, you know, one of its own fallen heroes, his own family, can't move back home. So they send out a contingent of Army officers to have a medal ceremony for the Masuda family and to bestow upon them the Distinguished Service Cross, which Kazuo Masuda had been awarded. Well, amongst those officers at this medal ceremony was a young white American captain named Ronald Reagan. And that evening, in front of America Rally Day, he addressed the crowd by saying, "The blood that has soaked into the sands is all of one color. America stands unique in the world, the only country not founded on race, but on an ideal. Mr. and Mrs. Masuda, as one member of the American family to another, for what your son Kazuo did, thanks." That story was relayed to President Reagan in the 80s, and his response was, "I remember what those soldiers did for America." It wasn't the only reason why he signed the Civil Liberties Act, but it personalized it, and it aligned the issue with his own personal and political values. And it is a very tangible example of how the actions and the accomplishments and the service of the Nisei soldiers of World War II went on to affect future generations.
Yeah, I mean, Masuda's comments go right back to what you said at the beginning of the podcast. You know, the wisdom of the American promise, and at least in some respect, you know, we see that being achieved. It may have taken another 30 or 40 years, but we've seen that achieved in those actions in the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. But now let's take it a step farther. How would you describe the relationship today of Asian and Japanese Americans in the Army and society?
You know, it's been 80 some years since World War II. We no longer see segregated units in our military. That in and by itself is a major step, not only for Japanese Americans, but for all Americans who believe in equality. In particular, for Asian Americans, we've seen Asian Americans, and in particular Japanese Americans, rise to the very highest rank in the Army. General Eric Shinseki, you know, four-star general who would later go on to become the secretary of the VA, or just an Army Chief of Staff, exactly. He is an example of how the ceiling is non-existent in concept, you know, for Japanese Americans and for all Americans to rise in the military. Now, certainly, there's still racism, there's still discrimination, as there is in any institution in our United States. You know, no institution is perfect. But I think we've come a tremendously long way in providing equal opportunity and the equal ability and opportunity to serve our nation.
Right. And finally, what would you say are the challenges, the current challenges of inspiring younger generations of Japanese and Asian Americans to get more involved in the military, to join the military, or to get involved in civic engagements?
You know, we oftentimes say that this is not a great Japanese-American story. This is a great American story. And I think that, to begin to answer your question, we should start with that premise, that what this story is about is the sons and daughters of immigrants who came to our nation and in one generation demonstrated what it means to be an American. And a big part of what it means to be an American is to serve, whether it's through military service or whether it's through civic engagement and serving our communities in whatever other forms and ways one is interested in doing. And so that's the challenge. That's the goal, if you will, of Go for Broke National Education Center, is to take the Go for Broke spirit of saying, we're all in, we're going to give it our all to serve the causes that we believe are important. You know, so whether it is military service, whether it's volunteering in community-based organizations, whether it is becoming active in civic and political activities, you know, we are focusing on the next gen, our next generation, to say, how do you best serve? And that is a part of what it means to be an American, and that's what it means to protect America's promise.
Is there anything else that we didn't bring up that you think is important for our audience to know about the Nisei experience in World War II?
One of the things I oftentimes close with is I refer back to the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who commented on the Japanese-American experience by saying that what happened to the Japanese-Americans during World War II was wrong. But Justice Scalia also said, you're kidding yourself if you think it will never happen again. In times of war, the laws fall silent. In times of war, the laws fall silent. Those are very chilling words for any American who believes in our Constitution, who cherishes that we are a nation of law. And so this story, as well as so many other stories, is a reminder to all Americans that we need to be vigilant to protect our laws, our Constitution, and that we are a nation of laws, not a nation of individuals.
Oh, excellent. No, thank you for that comment. And as we get towards the end here, we don't want to finish before our segment called Whoa Trivia. So is there a piece of significant Army trivia about the Nisei experience that you can share with us?
Yes. And it's a several-part trivia question. And so the first question is, or first part of the question is, how many medals of honor were bestowed upon the Nisei soldiers in the 100th 442nd?
Yeah, I don't have that answer.
Okay. All right. So, and the answer is 21. But the second, and this is the more important part of the question, really. How many of these medals of honor were bestowed during the World War II era?
Oh, yeah.
And the answer would be one. And it was not until the 1990s when Senator Akaka from Hawaii passed legislation saying, let's re-examine the record of Asian American soldiers, particularly Japanese American soldiers during World War II. And they re-evaluated the records of Distinguished Service Cross recipients and one Silver Star recipient. And as a result, 20 individuals were identified for being worthy of the Medal of Honor. And that the premise was that during World War II, because of the racism and discrimination, what normally would have been considered more than adequate and to be rewarded with the Medal of Honor, they were downgraded. So it wasn't until June of 2000 that President Clinton bestowed 20 additional medals of honor to Japanese American soldiers, seven of whom were still alive and 13 had passed by that time.
Yeah, and you know, that effort to go back, not just for Asian Americans, but Native Americans and African Americans, to go back and relook at some of these medals and upgrade them where they're deemed worthy. So that effort is still going on, and we here at the Center of Military History, we actually play an active role in that with the Department of the Army.
So this bit of trivia is perfect for you then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when you said it was only one awarded during World War II, my guess was zero, but because I knew a lot of them were upgraded later on.
Right. And in fact, so it was Sadao Munemori who received the Medal of Honor, and it was shortly after World War II, but it was in that era.
Dr. Maki, thank you so much for your insights today. about the role of the Nisei Japanese Americans in World War II and in Army history, and their continuing impact on race relations here within the United States and in the military.
Lee, thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been a great discussion. And if anyone wants to learn more about the history of the Nisei soldiers and Japanese Americans in World War II, then I encourage you to do two things. Check out Dr. Maki's website at goforbroke.org. That's goforbroke.org. Or you can go to history.army.mil. And I encourage you also to check out our social media if you're interested in daily Army history information. We're available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today on the United States Army History and Heritage Podcast. For the Center of Military History, I'm Lee Reynolds. And until next time, we're history.
The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or opinions of the U.S. Army or Department of Defense. For more information about the Army's proud history and heritage, go to history.army.mil.